This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Yesterday, Utah Governor Gary Herbert didn't exactly say the people have spoken, but it was close. He took the occasion of his monthly news conference on PBS Utah to announce that he and legislative leaders had decided to back off the tax proposal passed last month in a special legislative session. And back way off, actually. Starting Monday, when the 45-day session gets underway, they're going to begin the process of repealing the bill entirely and, at least according to the governor, go back to square one. The actual words the governor used were the will of the people. The decision to go back reflected the will of the people, he said. And what he meant, of course, was that there seemed to be enough people who had signed a signature petition to get a referendum on the ballot next fall to repeal the proposal. And that proposal, as you've heard by now, would have been the second largest tax cut in the state's history. And maybe voters wouldn't have minded that part, but they clearly weren't crazy about the other part, the part that raised the sales tax on food and services like Uber and car towing and streaming media. Just exactly what it means to go back to square one is not clear right now, and lawmakers have plenty of other things to talk about as well. So today in the program, we're going to be previewing the legislative session. We'll talk about taxes. We'll talk about the budget, education, air, housing, some of the message bills that inevitably come along in an election year. So joining us throughout the hour is Nicole Nixon, a reporter here at KUER, covering the politics and government. Nicole, welcome back.
Hi.
Ben Winslow is back with us. He's a reporter for Fox 13. He's been covering the session a long time now. Welcome. Thanks. Robert Gerke is back with us. He's a columnist for the Salt Lake Tribune. And Robert Gerke, welcome back to you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Were you guys surprised with yesterday's news that they were going to repeal?
Well, we were headed towards something.
Yeah.
And this had the potential to cast a huge shadow over the legislature because they really couldn't budget. They had planned for this bill to be implemented, for this $160 million tax cut to be going into effect, for the sales tax to be raised on groceries, gas, and imposing on some services. But then you have this referendum that's underway. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, how do you budget knowing that there's a chance that whatever you pass, voters could undo? And it was 152,000 signatures, according to referendum supporters, with a 94% validation rate of signatures, which is unheard of, which means that it was more than going to qualify for the November ballot.
So lawmakers saw the writing on the wall.
I think it just looked like that, and they had to change.
It still was a pretty stunning reversal from leadership, I think. I mean, I talked to Brad Wilson, the House Speaker, just last week, and he was still very defensive and, you know, pushing this. And
he was on the show last week. He was all for
it. Yeah. And even he wouldn't talk to reporters yesterday, but we did talk to the Senate President, Stuart Adams, and he says that he still thought that that bill was the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. But, you know, with the pressure of the referendum and the pressure of lawmakers to craft a budget, and they need the certainty, they need to know the numbers to make the budget during the session. That's their biggest job during the 45-day session. They decided to just repeal it.
And if I could just take a step back, I mean, let's talk about how surprising it is that they got the signatures, because we know how hard it is to get an initiative or get a referendum on the ballot to gather these 115,000 signatures
anyway,
all across the state.
And now in a couple of weeks, right?
In a very short period of time during the holidays. And I think the fact that Harmon's and Associated Foods, especially Associated Foods, got into this because Associated Foods gave them a toehold in rural outlying counties that they might not otherwise be able to reach. But whenever we've seen an initiative get the signatures before, it's because it's had millions of dollars behind it. And this didn't have that. I didn't think it was going to become anywhere near getting the signatures. And then when we saw it did, the leadership and the governor had kind of pushed it, to make a poker analogy, they pushed all their chips in on this. And the citizens called their bluff and they folded. And so I think, you know, it does completely transform the complexion of this upcoming session.
Okay, so looking at polling, I'm not sure how much was there, but there's a recent Salt Lake Tribune poll. 60% of Utahns said they opposed the plan. Only a quarter said they supported it. There was only 15% who didn't really have an opinion. So was it pretty clear what people didn't like?
I think by and large, you can point to the sales tax on food as being the sort of the poison pill that was in this. But then there were also people on the conservative side, on the right, who didn't like the tax reform proposal at all. They thought that they aren't convinced that we have a tax problem in the first place. And so the two of those kind of coming together, I think, created a big problem for the leadership. And I think the biggest problem for the leader for legislative leaders and the governor is they did a poor job of selling this to the public, of explaining to voters why we need to change our tax structure in the first place. And if you haven't laid the foundation, it's really hard to get public support behind it.
Let's not forget the revenge of the initiatives, though. Mm. People that I was talking to who were signing were still mad about that. They were mad about medical marijuana. They were mad about Medicaid expansion and the legislature overriding those. They were worried about redistricting, which could still happen this session. So there were a lot of people who were signing just because they felt that the legislature and their elected leaders were simply not listening to them. But far and away, like Robert said, the sales tax on food, number one reason anybody I talked to, why asking them, why are you signing this? Why are you doing this? Sales tax on food.
It's what the governor said. Here's something he mentioned in his news conference on PBS Utah yesterday.
Well, I think the increase of the sales tax on food was really probably the catalyst that drove this issue. Even though there was an attempt to say, look, you get a $40 million credit now with not paying the tax on food, with all the things we're going to be doing and redirecting monies to the poor, you'll have a $135 to $140 million benefit. It didn't translate. People didn't agree with that solution.
Robert, I guess that gets to what you're saying. They weren't selling it properly. I mean, the governor kept saying this is the second largest tax increase
or cut
in the state's history. Why is that not great for you?
Well, because I think people recognize that with the paying more at the cash register when you're buying groceries is a burden on low income people. There was this rebate that was built into it, and it actually got a lot better when they made it a prebate where low income people can get the money back before they pay it. But they didn't do a good job of explaining to people that that's how it was going to work. In a perfect world, frankly, that it probably would be a tax cut for most Utahns, almost all Utahns, and it would be beneficial and slightly more progressive for low-income Utahns. But again, we don't live in a perfect world. We live in a world where we end up repealing tax bills at the last second.
Well, and people don't like complicated tax plans. I mean, you hear Republicans often say that they think that a tax plan or a tax reform thing should fit on a postcard. But people just don't understand why they should be paying more in taxes up front and then getting rebates or prebates later. It just doesn't make sense to a lot of people, especially for something like food. And we've been talking about the food tax, but there are other issues that people really did not like about this, like the fact that it cut the income tax, mm-hmm. which is a direct cut to the education fund. Ben mentioned just the dissatisfaction with lawmakers. One woman told me that she just has been feeling like lawmakers can do whatever they want. And this was another example of that. And then there, like the tax on gas, people voted. There was a gas tax on the ballot in 2018. People voted that down. And people also told me that they thought that the gas tax would just mean that prices increase across the board. It would be another hike on things like food.
And I think especially in rural Utah, the gas tax was a big deal because rural drivers tend to drive more. And so the 11 cents a gallon that they projected it would cost increase or add to the cost of gas was a big issue for them.
What did you make of this? May be a sort of a side issue, but the governor kind of going after Harmans, I thought was mm-hmm. sort of interesting early on when he was talking about how they had a right to engage in the political process, but that they have a responsibility to deal with facts, not emotion. He said it was an ill-advised decision to be engaged in the process like they were. What did you make of that? Do you think there's anything kind of interesting or significant there?
They were not happy that Harmans was giving so much real estate to signature backers who were largely a Facebook group and an all-volunteer grassroots effort. It definitely helped advance this because it was a dedicated place people could go to sign. Harmon's, when I asked them, their CEO, what did they make of the governor's remarks, they just said, we respectfully disagree.
What's next now? Let's talk a little bit about what this all means. They've had to do the budgeting, and now this is changing. So how much time are they going to have to spend on budgets and reworking, fiscal notes and all of those
Kinds of things? Everything, right, Nicole?
Yeah, it really throws a wrench into their budget-making plans, I think. And while it's also very confusing because while Herbert released a budget plan that accounted for $160 million less in government spending, accounted for that tax cut, now lawmakers, you would think they have more money to spend, but they're really worried because their general fund money is, you know, it's not growing as fast, which is the whole problem in the first place from the sales tax.
Yeah.
So President Adams told us yesterday that he thinks that some proposals out there like funding for air quality, funding for affordable housing, funding proposals for increased mental health crisis services may not get as much money as they had hoped.
Are they going to be sort of paying back voters for their impertinence in that way?
At this point, there, at least I was told by the Senate president, Nicole, you may have been told similar, there's no plans for a major tax policy bill in the 2020 session. The governor made it clear. The Senate president backed it up. I'm sure the speaker is on board with that as well, which is, look, it's an election year. Everybody in the House is up for re-election. There's that to consider. The governor's office is up for election. There's going to be a new governor, and Governor Herbert said, "Let's just see what the new governor brings forward. You know, let's wait." And given that it is an election year, maybe a lot of members don't really want to, you know, poke a stick at the bear that is already angry. So, I don't think you'll see a lot of these major tax bills going through. You might see some little things. Even last night, Senator Andrig proposed a tax credit for out-of-pocket expenses for teachers. You might see smaller bills like that go through, but I don't think you're going to see anything major just given what we just went through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think from the vantage point of legislative leadership, they leaned on their members pretty hard, especially in the House, to support this bill. And there's some consternation in the caucus about them pulling the rug out from under him at the last minute. There's not an appetite in either the House or the Senate, I don't think, right now, to do anything significant. And as Ben mentioned, because most of the gubernatorial candidates came out in opposition to this, there's an inclination to just say, well, let them deal with it, right? We've done our work and let them deal with it. I think Nicole made a very good point, I think, and I don't know that it necessarily complicates the budgeting because there's now no money to budget. Before, you know, the governor came out with his budget that had all of this extra money for roads and for transportation, for jails and prisons, for air quality, for affordable housing. They're not going to have that money now. And not only that, before they passed this tax bill, they were looking at making cuts to a lot of programs just so they could reallocate the money. And those cuts have got to be back on the table now, I would assume. And so you're going to see it's going to be a high wire act of acrobatics to try to get the budget to balance without the money that they anticipated coming in from the sales tax and from the gas tax and from the sales tax on food.
Let me come back to one more sort of political dimension here in the story, and that is I wonder if – and it gets back to that question of the initiatives before, that played a role in voter dissatisfaction with this particular one. Are we going to be seeing more of this kind of thing where you have voters, in some cases moderate voters, maybe pushing back against the more extreme ideology of their elected representatives? Whereas for now, voting for a Democrat still may not be an option for most. They'll engage in a citizen initiative. They'll sign a petition for a referendum. Are we going to be seeing more of that?
I think so, just because it's been proven that it can be done, right? For so long, the conventional wisdom was that the bar was set so high for initiatives and referendum that there was no point in doing it. And then we saw these three get through in 2018, and now we've seen this referendum successful. I mean, if you have an organization behind you, you can do it. And I also think, because I'm an opinion columnist and I can say this sort of thing, I think what we've seen is that the legislature is out of touch with the average citizens of Utah. You've seen them on Medicaid expansion. The citizens supported it overwhelmingly. They wouldn't do it, so the citizens did it through initiative. The medical marijuana, the same thing. The redistricting commission, the same thing. And now on tax reform, you know, the legislature. If we live in a representative democracy, you wouldn't be having these problems if the democracy was representing the people it was supposed to be.
But in a counterpoint, in the same election cycle that people voted for those initiatives, they reelected the same people who did not like those initiatives.
Well, I mean, to some degree, yeah, I think there was a decent amount of turnover in 2018, more than we usually see. I also think that looking ahead to 2020, there are going to be members who have been safe in the past, who are concerned now. There are already members who are announcing they're not running again. And I think the one thing that you really need to watch is the inter-party challenges, because we live in a Republican state, right? And so oftentimes the Republican nominating contest is the one that decides who wins and who loses in November. I think you're going to see a lot of inter-party challenges that you maybe hadn't seen before.
Challenges from more moderate members?
Challenges from more conservative members, frankly, in a lot of cases, but also, you know, across the spectrum. Just some of the frustration, I think, that's going to be focused on the representatives who, in the public's eyes, in these last two cycles we've seen, are not necessarily doing the jobs that they've been elected to do.
I want to ask finally about this. So the former lawmaker who helped spearhead this signature gathering effort, Fred Cox, has said he wants the process to continue. He said, we still want the signatures to be verified. We want the process to continue. What happens? What does that mean?
I think that's trust but verify. Right?
Is that right?
I mean, trust the governor and the legislative leadership when they say they're going to repeal it, but make sure they do. And until they do, you don't put down your weapon.
I don't think that legally they can stop counting until there's a repeal. Theoretically, if there's no bill, there's no referendum to vote on, you know, or if there's no law, tax law. So and as of this morning, they'd already cleared 90,000 signatures. It's the lieutenant governor's office is still verifying those signatures, because until the legislature actually repeals this, everything's going forward, even though it we don't know what it really means, if it means anything at all.
Yeah.
Yeah, what struck me about talking to Fred Cox yesterday after that announcement was he did not seem – I'm sure he was very excited, but he did not sound as excited as I imagined he would.
Really?
He just said, look, either way, what we want is for this to not go into effect. And whether that happens legislatively or whether that happens through the referendum, either way is fine with me. But yeah, I think once that actually does happen, if that repeal does happen legislatively, then he can be breathing a sigh of relief.
And I think we need to come back to and maintain some focus on the fact that there still is a significant budget problem in the state of Utah.
Yep.
We've got an education fund that is growing at a rapid clip from income tax revenues, and we've got everything else that's funded through sales tax revenue that's not growing. It's not keeping pace with the demands of the state. And something is going to need to be done. It's just not going to be done this year.
And yeah, that reckoning is coming, and it's still going to be an uncomfortable conversation with voters and residents of Utah who are now kind of realizing how important tax policy really is. While it sounds boring and
complicated
and annoying, it touches every single human life in this state. And so that reckoning may come in 2021. It may come in 2022. The Senate president told me that fiscal cliff that they're worried about may be 1 or 2 years out, but it's still coming.
All right. So what are you expecting? Robert Gerke, let me start with you. Any big themes in the session that aside from money, I guess?
Well, I think that's what's now really interesting about this session is we don't have a big theme. If you look at the last few years, last year it was tax reform. The year before that, there was debates over medical marijuana and Medicaid. We don't have big overarching issues this session. So I think it ends up being a lot of smaller issues. And because there's not a lot of money to spend, those smaller issues tend to flare up a little hotter than they might otherwise. It's also an election year. And so you see a lot of bills, message bills, as they're called, that come out. I think if I could put maybe one theme on the upcoming session, I think it's going to be growth. And you look at the transportation, the air quality, education, all of these issues are driven by the growth that we've seen in the state for the past several years. And so thematically, if you could point to one thing, I think that's how we deal with that now and going forward is going to be the big challenge for legislators as they come into this next 45 days.
What do you see, Ben?
Oh, you're going to have a lot of little stuff that pops up. I think we're all still just kind of a little shell-shocked with the tax reform situation. But, you know, there's going to be the usuals that at least I always chase. There's always a cannabis bill. There's a liquor bill. You know, there's going to be some bills probably dealing with LGBTQ rights, those types of things that will get some attention.
We'll get to the details of some of those, by the way, as we go along. I find it interesting, Nicole, that Speaker Wilson, in laying out his priorities, I'm not sure if it was number three, but right up there in his priorities was affordable housing. So that I found that quite interesting. And transportation, getting maybe to that growth
issue.
Yeah,
I think it is a growth issue. And he when he took over as Speaker last year, came out, you know, kind of insane that growth is his priority and will be for the foreseeable future, like managing the growth. And roads is something, transportation and road maintenance is been a big issue for lawmakers. They've been spending, I think, a lot more than they want to on road repairs and new roads and things like that. And affordable housing, you know, Brad Wilson's a developer. He's a home builder. Mm-hmm. So he said he has a front row seat to that. I think just something to keep in mind is that, you know, we've seen probably 4,000 apartments going up in downtown Salt Lake, just downtown, in the past decade. And most of them are above market rate. So while Wilson and other Republican leaders say, like, that a free market is, you know, the best solution and can drive that, it's not – that hasn't really been what we've seen, at least downtown, where that affordable housing pinch is harder, and that is moving into Salt Lake County too.
Yeah, well, I want to get back to the affordable housing question too. Let's talk about the governor's budget that he has in mind as it compares to what lawmakers have in mind. I mean, traditionally, there's always that tension. I'm sure that
two very different budgets.
Yeah, what's the difference?
Governor proposes one, legislature passes one.
Right.
And that really is what it is. The governor makes these recommendations. These are the things I would like to see you invest in. He called for $100 million for air quality, which included some very big initiatives, including building out the electric car grid in hopes of converting more people to electric cars. There was also just more for mass transit, which he said we've hit critical mass. The speaker told me that, look, we've with the mass transit investments we've already made, we've managed to take two lanes off of I-15 along the Wasatch Front already, which is significant because they've already had discussions about the idea of double-decker I-15. They're going to have to talk more about transportation and mass transit. But as you know, it's complicated. Yeah. There's a lot of factors there. You got to get frequency of rides to get people on the rides. You got to have it cheaper so that people don't feel like they're priced out of riding the bus. Convenience, always a big issue. And what do you do with UTA? You know, how does UTA manage it and do all of that? And you know, there's just a lot to work on there. The idea of pushing people more toward electric vehicles by expanding the grid statewide, it's ambitious. But the legislature has other budgetary priorities.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Are they of the same mind, the governor?
Not always. Yeah. No. In fact, sometimes it's very different. Governor last year proposed $100 million for air quality, for example. Legislature funded $29 million, which was a record because previously it's been, what, like $2, $3 million, something like that? So it was a significant investment in air quality.
But it didn't get close to what the governor wanted.
Not what the governor wanted, yeah. But the legislature is like, look, we have other priorities too. Everybody wants something from us.
I wonder about the governor wants a freeze on college tuition, for example. Doesn't seem legislative leaders are keen on that one.
Question is, does the governor even have the authority to do so?
Yeah.
We asked him and he said no, but he appoints the Board of Regents, so there's a little political pressure there.
Yeah, I think this might take some time because he said that he wanted the Board of Regents to come up with a definition for affordability first, and they're not even going to get to that until their meeting in March after the session or very close to the end of the session. So this might be something that comes back next year, if at all.
What do you see, Robert, in the governor's budget as compared to lawmakers' priorities?
Well, I mean, there were some things I really liked in the governor's budget, and I think there's some appetite or some pressure on legislators to deal with them. The mental health funding that he proposed, about $30 million there. And there are legislators who are already championing those bills. You know, as Ben mentioned, the air quality is a big issue. I think there's a consensus that education will do well this session. I don't know if they'll do quite as well as they had hoped to. I mean, because they benefit in one hand from the tax repeal that we were talking about, mm-hmm. because there's not going to be those significant $680 million reductions on education. And so, you know, they've already agreed to fund the growth that's coming in. So I think education could do quite well. Affordable housing is a question mark now, I think, because, without this sales tax revenue that we talked about, it's going to be harder for them to fund affordable housing grants and matching funds and so forth. It's kind of up in the air a little bit. Again, the governor's budget, Ben was giving me a hard time before, but I always tell this story. One year I called the Senate president and said, well, what do you think of the governor's budget? And he says, well, I really appreciate him sending it up. Now my table's level. These recommendations that the governor makes don't often amount to much, yeah. but it is sort of an aspirational vision of where he would like to see things go. And the legislature will do what the legislature wants to do.
People are going to wonder about air. The governor's put I think his is $100 million.
Yeah,
right?
He threw it down again.
Efforts, right? So, what do you figure will happen? How much of that will emerge?
There is a desire to deal with transit and transportation, especially amongst legislative leadership, because they do see the growth that's happening. The growth is going to drive a lot of this, and. Unless you want double-decker I-15, which it
or
sounds
if,
like...
unless you want to pay for that.
And pay for it, too, yes. Then, you know, you've got to fund it somehow. And you've got to fund if this electric grid thing, it seems intriguing to a lot of lawmakers that I've talked to. So, you know, that those could have some legs. How much money they get, though, again, in the face of so many budgetary demands for this program, that program, this program. And remember, constituents say, I like this. How do you pay for it?
One of the interesting things on air quality, I think, is that a good chunk of the money that the governor proposed is settlement money from the Volkswagen lawsuit. Mm-hmm. And they've used that money in the past to retrofit school buses, to change them from diesel to cleaner, you know, get the old big trucks off the road. And the Utah Foundation did a report recently that said that that's the most effective, you know, bang for the buck, really, is to get those big polluters off the road. So, you know, that's something that I think we can probably look forward to. And it's also something that money has to be spent on air quality measures under the terms of the settlement. So I think there's a good chance we'll see some progress there.
Well, on the subject of earmarks, so Utah's the only state in the country. Governor Herbert pointed this out in his news conference yesterday, that the only state in the country with a constitutional earmark on income tax. And what that means is that all the taxes the state collects on income taxes, all that money has to go to education. And there's been some talk about changing all of that. So what do you think is going to happen on the Hill about adjusting that? Are they going to deal with that?
I think that's the big question mark this year, because if they did it this year, they could put it on the ballot in November and have voters weigh in on it. And then in 2021, when they decide to take up tax reform again, then they could have some clarity about what the education fund and the income tax earmark will look like. But is there the political will now to do that? I'm not so sure about that.
Yeah, I don't know. Representative Ward has already proposed a proposed constitutional amendment. And this is a constitutional amendment, which means it has to go to voters.
Yeah.
The same voters who likely signed the referendum, sparked all of this. It just raises the question, do you want to go there?
Yeah.
And I don't know if this is the session where you go there.
Well, and I think polling has showed that Utahns want to keep that constitutional earmark as well.
Yeah, I mean, not to give away too much, but we have a poll coming out in the near future that shows that, as Nicole mentioned, the public supports it. And I think given the fact that the public supports it, I don't know. And the legislature still licking its wounds from this tax fight. I don't think there's an appetite to do that. They also don't really have to do that. I mean, they've shown with this recent tax reform, if they cut the income tax and move the money out of there, then they don't have to take away the earmark. Senator Bramble, for example, argues that the earmark doesn't actually mean anything. It just means the legislators have to be a little bit more creative about how they get around it. And so, for example, one of the things that you might actually see on tax issues this year that was in the tax bill is they want to take the alcohol money that has been funding the school lunch program and take that out of the education fund. And that doesn't do anything to the earmark, but it reduces the education funding, increases the sales tax available for other programs.
There's a state senator who every year asks for money for affordable housing, Jake Anderegg.
And he was not happy he didn't get his money last year.
Yeah, not at all. He's asking for $35 million this year. Mm-hmm. Most of it, he says, would help fund new development, more affordable housing.
Transit-oriented development.
What's he going to get? If they're talking about actually paying attention to affordable housing, is this going to happen? Are the lawmakers going to do anything about that?
There's certainly a chance. There was a lot of disappointment that did not get the appropriation that he had requested last year, and it was like $25 million,
something like that.
And so there's really a strong chance, especially in the face of all these growth and affordability issues like Nicole mentioned.
$35 million, does that even put
it's a start.
It's better than
start.
Nothing.
It's better than nothing. I guess that's true. That is because that's what they got last year was nothing. I want to ask about rent control. This is a measure sponsored by Salt Lake City Representative Jennifer Daley Provost. Explain exactly what it does, because it doesn't actually impose rent control, but it gives local municipalities the
ability to
talk about it. Yeah.
Right now there is a prohibition, and I learned this through reporting on Representative Daley Provost's bill. I did not know this because I would ask the Salt Lake City Council with the downtown bougie lofts that are going up everywhere and, you know, with all of these housing options or these things that are popping up, is anybody discussing rent control? Because people are being priced out. You know, I mean, the rent is too dang high. But
you can say damn.
I can on NPR. Yeah, awesome. I mean, I work for Fox. We can say a lot worse, folks. But this would remove that. And all she says is even the representative isn't even convinced that she's a fan of rent control. She even says.
But she just wants people to be
able
to talk about it.
She wants cities to be able to have these uncomfortable conversations with their constituents about whether we do this or not. It may not be a popular bill on the Hill where people believe that, again, free market principles should be at play here. But she says that this is a difficult conversation even the legislature needs to have about whether municipalities should be able to have these conversations.
Nicole, you talked to Stuart Adams about this particular one. He mentioned – he did the refrain, market
free,
solutions
free
are
market
the
was yeah. the first phrase out of his mouth. I think that and again, I think he has some interest in building housing as well. This will be a very interesting debate, and I don't know if it has – I don't know what chance it has, but it would be an interesting debate. It reminds me of, this discussion about local control and the state, like, imposing its will on cities in Utah. And it reminds me of bills we've seen the past couple of years to block cities from banning plastic bags and single-use plastic items.
I think that's a really interesting point. That's something that I think we should watch is these preemption laws that the legislature does every year. I don't think rent control has a snowball's chance. I think it goes against every instinct that the conservative Republican legislators.
What you mean
have.
Imposing rent control or just letting them talk about it?
Anything that would open the door even a crack to let cities do that. Because look, I mean, if they won't let cities, you know, charge for plastic bags, they're certainly not going to let cities start monkeying with the rental markets. They don't let them have a minimum wage. There are all of these bills that come in and step on city authority. I mean, and we saw with the Inland Port, for example, the legislature is not shy about coming in and telling cities what to do. And so I don't think that rent control has legs.
Okay, it's an election year. So what does that mean in terms of message bills? Robert, I think you referenced this earlier. We'll probably see a few. I want to talk about a few that come to mind. What are you expecting in that way?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, to define message bills first for listeners, these are bills that are just mostly intended to cater to their base. And so you see a bill like Brad Dawe is sponsoring that would prohibit minors from doing hormone therapy or going through a gender transition surgery. And this is something we've seen in other states. Senator Dan McKay is going to be sponsoring a bill that we've seen in other states as well that would prohibit abortion from the time of conception. These are bills that are clearly directed at their base voter. It's red meat for the masses. And so you see those and they end up being huge fights and getting a lot of attention, and sometimes they pass, and sometimes when they do pass they don't actually do anything, but it is election posturing.
So you're starting to see these bills in conservative states, I think more than a dozen of these, South Dakota, Florida, that deal with, as Robert mentioned, that question of what do you do with transgender young people. Some of the bills prohibit doctors from providing certain medical treatment. Some of the bills actually keep students, trans students, from playing on sports mm-hmm. teams that with the gender that they identify with, those kinds of things. What are we seeing with the – you mentioned the Representative Brad Dawe is proposing one of these. What are you seeing with the Utah version of all of that?
Well, Representative Dawe says he's still working on it. Huh. And groups like Equality Utah are seeking to meet with him to discuss, what this kind of legislation would look like. There's also another bill by Representative Robertson out of Provo who says that district by district right now, each school district has its own policy as far as transgender athletes. And he would like to see a statewide uniform policy, but he doesn't quite know what that looks like yet, what he's envisioning. There's no bill language. These bills have not been made public. But obviously they're concerning for LGBTQ rights groups who don't like them and view them as attempting to erase transgender people from existence.
What strikes me about these bills, two things, is that they're very controversial, but we haven't seen many of them made public yet. And I don't know if that's just a crush of legislation or if they're holding off until later in the session to do those. Brad Dawe was quoted in The Washington Post yesterday. They did a story about all of these bills that seem to be modeled after South Dakota and, have their own variations. Brad Dawe seemed a little hesitant about his bill would ban hormone therapy and surgery for children, but right. Some of these bills also block
puberty blockers
yep. And he was considering removing that from his bill. He said after meeting with transgender people and advocates, he learned that puberty blockers, you can take those, but if you stop taking them, then puberty will kickstart. So they're not like a permanent thing that he would be concerned about. So. I'm just surprised we haven't seen any actual language for any of these bills that could be very fiery yet.
A lot of times it's a strategic decision they make. They can hold these bills back for a long time. And part of it is, as Nicole mentioned, they're still in process. They're mm-hmm. still being worked on, and he's still, meeting with the interested parties. But also, we always see surprise bills come out later in the session because they can keep these things private for quite some time until they drop him out.
I'm not sure we should spend too much time on this mascot resolution, but let's say something about it. It does seem like a message sort of thing. It's a resolution, as I understand it, mm-hmm. sponsored by a Republican representative in Cedar City, Rex Shipp, which would – let me read this, see if I get it right. The bill would discourage the removal of mascots or logos or the names of indigenous people unless there's a consensus by these native groups,
This is in response to the Cedar City High School Red Men controversy.
Yes.
And that was very divisive. The Iron County School District did ultimately decide to retire the mascot, and students selected a different one. I believe it's the Reds now. And this is in response. It was a very divisive issue in that community.
Well, it's interesting that he mentions the having support from majority or, of Native American groups. There's a rally at the Capitol tomorrow organized by the League of Native American Voters and Native groups to protest this resolution. I think they're very much against it.
Yeah, not much consensus there.
Yeah.
No, and I think the I think it's sort of problematic whenever the majority white population is requiring somebody to form consensus to remove their own image or name from mm-hmm. being a mascot. And you know, I think Redmond, most of us would agree, is a fairly outdated pejorative term and should have gone away, but it did divide the community, and we're seeing a reaction to that now, I guess.
So, while we're on the sort of indigenous peoples, there's an interesting piece of legislation, actually co-sponsored piece of legislation, Republican Senator David Hinkins, Democratic Representative Angela Romero, on missing and murdered indigenous women.
Mm-hmm. And LGBTQ+.
Yes. What do we know? Just say
two of the most politically opposite lawmakers teaming up.
Yeah.
Senator Hinkins is very conservative. Representative Romero is very liberal. And it's really interesting. And she got through last year a resolution designating, I believe it was May 5th, missing, murdered indigenous women and girls and LGBTQ+ day, a recognition day of resolution. And this is an extension of that. This would create a task force to study an issue that does seem to be a problem, which is police agencies not necessarily doing due diligence, not necessarily investigating some of these disappearances and crimes and sort of dismissing them and pushing more toward investigating them and providing proper resources to do so.
I've been really pleased to see this issue gaining bipartisan support. I mean, this week the president signed created a task force to look at these issues and focus on them. Senator Hinkins, as Ben mentioned, is very conservative, but he also represents the Senate district that by far has the largest proportion of Native Americans in it. And I think it's important that people will be aware of these issues, and it's good to see that the legislature is interested in doing something about it.
There is a bill sponsored by Representative Romero that would require clergy to hear – when clergy hears about abuse, they have to report it to law enforcement. She's Catholic, and the Catholic Diocese of Salt Lake City really opposed to this. What's going to happen with this particular bill? And I wonder just how the LDS Church, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, if they're going to weigh in on this or what's going to happen there.
Well, that's certainly the X factor there is if there was ever an institution that certainly does exercise a lot of influence on the legislature, it is that one, and it remains to be seen. They say they're still reviewing the bill.
Right. And there's a confessional aspect to the relationship between Mormon clergy and
there's a lot of faiths that practice confessional, and this would affect them. She argues that this is about protecting children and that, look, you could stop further victimization if you report what you are told to law enforcement. And obviously some of these faith groups, the Catholic Diocese of Salt Lake City being particularly opposed to this, saying that, look, this pierces the veil of confessional and that they put their own priests at risk for excommunication. She disagrees with that. But, this is going to be an interesting bill to see how far it goes. It's certainly gotten a lot of reaction before the sessions even started.
I don't think it'll go far, but the speaker's already said that he's opposed to it. I doubt that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints will even have to weigh in on it. It does put two.
But if they do, they. If they get a sense,
I can't see them supporting it. I mean, for two reasons. One is that they want to preserve their confidentiality of the penitent clergy relationship, but also that it could expose them to some civil liability. The legislative attorneys and even the sponsor who've looked at it say it could do that. And so I think that it's not something that they're going to be – they would never be supportive of it. But it does pit two fundamental values, our belief in the freedom of religion and our belief in protecting children, in conflict with each other. And, I wrote the other day that I believe we should come down on the side of protecting children. And it also, there was an argument made that this also helps the person, the perpetrator of these acts, get help and stop, preying on minors. So, you know, it's an important discussion to have. But again, it seems unlikely that it's going to go too far.
Ben, one of the things you did say, though, is that people may be underestimating or dismissing Angela Romero a little too easily on this one.
She has a knack for getting some pretty controversial bills through, or at least bills that at first blush are controversial. She has run a number of abuse bills that have faced pushback, and they've passed and been signed by the governor. I wouldn't rule her out. She has ways of getting some of these bills through. And this one may take a few years, but it's possible that she's at least told me she won't give up on this one.
And we have seen some other states go this direction.
And these are not conservatives, or these are not liberal states. These are like Texas has one right now.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we have to talk about liquor laws. Like, don't we?
We always talk about liquor laws.
Okay, there's a wine bill. What's the – tell us
wine
about –
Wine of the Month Club.
Wine of the Month Club. Tell us about this bill and whether it has a chance.
Well, we'll see where it goes. But what is more surprising about this is who is running it? Representative Mikkel is a Republican Latter-day Saint lawmaker from Spanish Fork who doesn't drink and who really didn't know that this was a problem until some constituents, particularly who work in the Silicon Slopes area, brought it to him. They were moving in from out of state. They were complaining that they, you know, that they can't order Wine of the Month Club because it is legally prohibited in Utah. Right. So he's running a bill to allow it. Now, the catch is, and there's always a catch with liquor laws, is that the DABC would be your Uber Eats driver, essentially.
Right.
That you order through the Wine of the Month Club, and the DABC is going to have to deliver it to you. And that is to verify, look, there's a few things, that you are 21 and legally able to purchase alcohol, and that, you know, it removes the DUI threat, he believes. It'll be interesting to see where it goes. Another interesting little side bit of this is it removes a very rarely used – there was like maybe 7 cases in the last 3 months where if you move into Utah from out of state, you are legally required to declare your liquor stash with the DABC. And it removes that provision too. He doesn't believe it opens the door for bootlegging full on here in Utah, but that it just removes this idea that you have to call the DABC, pay them $20 because it's all about the tax, and you know, and therefore you can bring in your out-of-state stash because you're moving here again, yeah. Not just because you went to Lee's discount liquor.
Is the sentiment changing at all? Really, when it comes to alcohol in this state on Utah's Capitol Hill?
I think a little bit. You have just in the past 3 years seen them loosening a bit with 5% beer last mm-hmm. year. The falling of the Zion curtain, that was part of a big liquor reform bill in 2017. And now you have this. As people move to Utah from out of state, I think, and Mike Mikkel is a good example of lawmakers listening to maybe their new constituents who aren't from Utah and who do drink.
What do you think?
I mean, I think it's evolving. You know, I don't know that we're anywhere near having, you know, privatization or
wine and grocery stores.
That's not happening.
It's a discussion that's being had. This discussion about mail order wine has been in the works for 4 or 5 years now, and they've been trying to make some headway in it. They were trying to make it part of the package that was going, you know, that raised the alcohol content of beer. There are a couple bugs that I think need to be worked out in the current bill. For example, you know, if you order from wine.com and it goes to DABC, does DABC then mark up your $20 bottle of wine 88%?
Plus delivery fee.
add a delivery fee on it, because then you're paying $60 for a $20 bottle of wine, and that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Those are things that would need to be worked out. But, you know, and I also I'm frankly opposed to the ban on delivering to habitual drunks, because I would like to be able to get some, too.
NPR has a Wine of the Month Club.
There you go. Yeah. Well, we can't get it, and maybe Representative Mikkel will be
the perfect final
point. That was a great plug.
Robert Gerke, columnist for the Salt Lake Tribune. Nicole Nixon, a reporter here at KUER. Ben Winslow, a reporter at Fox 13. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Stay in touch. We'll keep
45 days to go.
That's right.
It's 45 days to go.
Radio West is a production of KUER. Natu Tuet is our intern. The show produced by Benjamin Bombard, Tim Slover, and Ale Vallarta. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.